When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yellowstone Season 2, Episode 4 is over, but we are just getting started over here at Post Show Recaps. Welcome back, my friends. It is I, Rich Liberto, DM Philly, out here on the internet, back with you again to talk about Episode 4 of Season 2, All the Devils. I, of course, am not alone. I am joined by a woman who often gets beat up by my debt collectors when they show up at the ranch, the one and only Grace Leader. Grace, how are you?
Good. Where all the angels go? It's just devils.
They're all
horns and tridents. God. Yeah, only the devils left, Rich.
Only the devils. What'd you think of this week, Grace?
I liked it a lot. I think that it starts off with I was going to say a bang, and I don't know if that's like if that's rude to the cows that all got loaded.
I think it's more like a fart. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, cows, I've suffered with some bloat as well, so don't you worry. Although, yeah, and sometimes they do end up in the exact same, like, fetal position that they were in. But, yeah, it starts off, like, I think a storyline that is, like, tense, but only as tense for this show. Like, if any other show is, like, all the cows have got bloated and they
the
died.
The cows it's like, got gas!
Yeah, it's like, who cares, you know? But in this show, it's such a central thing, and I like the way we sort of float through the episode. I thought it's a really good, you know, like, I know it sounds silly because we've only been like, this is only week 3 and it's only episode 4 of a 10 episode season, but it feels like we're like kicking into gear this season. I don't know. I liked it.
Yeah, I really like the tone of episode of season 2, I should say, a lot more than season 1 so far. I feel like we've planed out some of the manic energy a little bit. I felt like this week went very quick, even though it is not a shorter episode runtime wise. It felt like a shorter episode runtime wise, and I think that that's just because it's a little less shotgunned all over the place. It's a bit more
there focused. Is a shotgun.
There is a shotgun, to be sure. It does not go off. R.I.P. that guy's kid. But I feel like it's just a little bit more streamlined and focused this episode, and it went really quick for me in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's pretty full, and yet it doesn't feel like filler. Again, this is all the cow bloat puns that I'm gonna do. It was definitely filler for those cows. Yeah, I didn't feel like there was much clover in this episode, despite there being a lot of clover, in the sense that I thought sort of everything's moving along. And moving along, but also like, yeah, there's like this like attack on the Dutton farm, on the Yellowstone ranch, that like that's the impetus to kick off the episode. I think interestingly, like John says, like, I know who did this, and we cut to people who we might presume who did this, but we don't actually. I think maybe I'm totally wrong. I don't know that we necessarily have full confirmation as to who this is. And that's one thing I kind of like about the show, is when all these external threats to John Dutton as he's trying to like fend everything off. And I feel like this is a good example of that. And there's lots of tension between Jamie and Beth. And there's even, you know, there's some stuff here with Casey that I thought was interesting. So excited to chat through it.
Yeah, me too. I think I have a lot of questions for you, and I think that you're right that it's not a foregone conclusion who airdropped the clover onto the ranch to get the cows all gassy, as it were. There's some real interesting stuff here, but I think that you identify a bunch of really important ingredients to essential Yellowstone that I hadn't necessarily considered until you just identified them. But it's like Beth giving hell to Jamie, Casey's gonna kill somebody, we got cow problems, we got new enemies being introduced to John's ranch. Like, it is all that stuff, right?
Dan love Jenkins John coming
screwed over.
Yeah, love John coming, be like, hey Casey, like, what happened? He's like, he's like I don't have a gun. He's like, that's not what I asked. Did you shoot the man?
It's a fair assumption,
fair question. Yeah,
when you show up at a murder scene and the first thing you think is, who, why did my kid kill this guy? I got a little bit of a long short recap, and then we can talk through it all and try to answer our questions, Grace.
Yeah, let's do it.
let us do it. So we open on Casey asking Rip why Jimmy and Walker are branded. The men end up finding a bloated cow, something we learned should not be the case this time of year, before they find the whole herd laid over sick with bloat. Jamie, Beth, and John meet with the governor to discuss Jamie's former opponent being sworn in as the attorney general. John knows who poisoned his cattle, and he calls in livestock agents as Dan goes to meet with Thomas about the Beck brothers moving in on their plan. Thomas ultimately lets Dan know that the land has been annexed by the tribe, despite that not being their original agreement. Back on the ranch, John is talking to the sheriff, asking for more men to investigate what happened to the herd. The pair of them argue, and John ultimately forces the sheriff to deputize Casey on the spot. He ends up telling Jamie and Casey that he knows who did this, and he sends Jamie to go find the evidence, telling Casey to drag them back to him by their hair. Jamie, meanwhile, finds paperwork regarding the ranch's trust with Casey's signature on it, though Casey doesn't know anything about it at all. Beth explains that he isn't in the trust because she thinks he has no role at the ranch anymore. Jamie's furious because he thinks that she's tied up the money that they're going to need to deal with the fallout from this poisoned herd. Meanwhile, Jimmy's assailants from the hardware store show up at the ranch and go after an old man who may or may not be his grandfather. And John orders the entire field with the clover in it burned so that the clover cannot seed for the next year. The Beck brothers show up at the ranch looking for John, and Rip ends up tangling with their security team and getting one of their guns before he turns it on the men. John and Jamie get involved in the whole altercation, and the Becks explain they just want to discuss a mutual problem. John reluctantly agrees, and they explain that their enterprises don't overlap with his at all, and they would make good allies against Dan and Thomas. Jamie thinks working with them is dealing with the devil, but John says all the angels are gone and there's only devils left these days. Meanwhile, Monica's physical therapist has showed up to watch her teach her class and invites her to take a walk, but she gets uneasy and pushes him away. Casey gets a call from her, and they very clearly miss each other, though she's still apparently holding him at arm's length. John, Beth, and Jamie meet with Cassidy, the attorney general elect, to discuss their strategy about dealing with Thomas and Dan's plan. Beth is taking the moment to implicate Jamie in a prior livestock raid, but John shuts it down. Cassidy seems agreeable to their agenda. They invite her over for dinner, where Beth tells Jamie she's going to get him disbarred and makes a scene at the dinner table, controlling the seating arrangements and seemingly stabbing her brother under the table. Casey, meanwhile, shows up at Monica's apartment, and Tate finds the pair of them in bed together later that night. John has Casey running around looking for the plane that was used to drop the clover in his field and tells him to call the sheriff if they find anything and to do it by the book. Casey and the other livestock officers stop by to visit a rancher who lost his cow to wolves. And while Casey is getting impatient, they head over to the neighbor's ranch. They end up finding a weed whacker used to mutilate one of the neighbor's cows to make it look as though wolves have killed it also. But when they try to arrest him, his son pulls a shotgun on the pair of them. Casey almost talks the young man down, but the other officer kills the boy, saying he had no choice. John arrives, asking whether or not it was justified, and Casey says that it was, but that doesn't make it right. The sheriff, meanwhile, shows up angry that after one day, Casey has been involved in a shooting, and John knocks him out, saying that he failed to meet his word. He did not send his son back up when he called. Meanwhile, the Becks hear the whole story and say that they know how they can help John, and we watch as the ranchers set fire to his field. That, Grace, is episode 4 of season 2 of Yellowstone. A lot of stuff went down.
Beth stabbed Jamie. What the hell?
Yeah.
What the hell?
Am I reading that wrong? She definitely is stabbing him under the table with a knife, right?
Yeah, and then she's like, he's got celiac disease, so he's got a gut. I love John being like, he has what?
Yeah,
I'm very familiar with celiac disease because it's very common in people who live with type 1 diabetes to also get another like autoimmune disease. So I'm very familiar with celiac disease. And so the idea he just says, ow, that he gets up after being stabbed by Beth. They are a wild family. Beth was pretty deranged in season 1. She's getting there. She's getting back. She's getting back to her little old self. in season two here. That's not actually where I want to start. I want to start with the stabbing, but then also I don't know where I want to start.
If you listen closely, you could hear the sound of the roller coaster cars being pulled up to their apex as Beth is gaining momentum. Yeah. The story of Beth Dutton is a very dynamic one across Yellowstone. There's a reason that I think so many people are so high on this character, but she's absolutely out of control. Just to like, before we move on from the stabbing, the double whammy of Jamie getting stabbed, the fact that like she does this to him to embarrass him in front of his old opponent, but then also that she kind of humiliates him in front of John. Like, John seemingly is really like bummed out that Jamie might have
celiac disease. It's the only thing maybe would be worse was if he's like, I'm a vegetarian, you know, but
That's not gonna fly unless he wants to eat a bunch of clover, because there's a ton of extra clover on the ranch. That's probably a good place to start. We could start at the beginning, as we often do, where they're gonna end up burning this field. This is a thing, you know, plants have seeds, and when they dry, the seeds generally are ripe, and then you drop them on the ground and they can reseed. So you need your cows not to be eating this clover. They're gonna bloat. It's bad for them. Somebody clearly dropped it here. Back to the question that you posed, though, Grace. John Dutton says a couple of times he knows who did this. So there's two questions that I want to ask you. Who does John think did it? And then who do we think did it?
Well, I don't know if the answer to I guess there's one other question that I think you could ask, which is, who does the show want us to think did it? Which is very clearly Thomas Rainwater and Dan Jenkins. Some combination of them. Because he says, I know who did it, and we cut to a scene with Thomas Rainwater and Dan Jenkins. And me, a person who's watched a lot of TV, is like, you're not going to trick me. Although sometimes I'm like, oh, I want the show to think I'm really dumb, and this could be the way of it being like, hey, you fool, we told you the whole time Thomas Rainwater and Dan Jenkins. But I kind of think this is very similar to like earlier. I'm correcting myself, Rich, for the moment when you were like, you think Dan is actually dead? And I was like, oh, damn it, we didn't see the body. So, right? So I think that the fact that we don't see any scenes of people being like, did you make sure the helicopter like log route doesn't set, you know, there's no like scheming. We don't really hear anything. I don't know. Suspects on the board is certainly, I think, obviously Thomas Rainwater, Dan Jenkins. I think to a degree, you could argue perhaps the Becks. I think, although that doesn't, I don't think that that's very strong. So I can't really think of anybody else, but if it feels like this is like, you know, I've watched a lot of murder mysteries over the last year or so. I watched Poker Face, which every episode was a murder mystery. Obviously Glass Onion came out this year, and I feel I just feel like it typically has to be someone you've already, like, we have to have the suspect on the board, I think,
somebody,
but I can't,
that we've met, right? I think you're overlooking some prime suspects who are the guys that came to beat up Jimmy. Are we not thinking about them? You don't think maybe they rented a helicopter and threw the clover out? Just
no, if they're trying to gather $8,000, I don't think that they're, I mean,
$8,000, they got to pay for the helicopter.
Yeah, that poor old man who's getting beat up on Jimmy's bed. Is that his father? Who is that? No, not father.
I don't really know. Yeah, I don't think it's his grandfather. We meet Jimmy's grandfather who like goes to John and gets him the job. And this is kind of Jimmy's only survivor. I love the idea that it's just this old man who comes to bitch at Jimmy, and we have no idea who he is, and don't even try to like connect him back into Jimmy. It's kind of bold to me as a decision, you know.
Hilarious. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, it feels like there's got to be somebody that I'm very obviously missing. And then it could just be that it's Thomas and Dan perhaps, but I don't know. It's a very sinister plot. Luckily I kind of love the way that obviously by the end you have to burn the clover. Like John knows exactly like and I actually think the exposition on like why this is really bad and how they know that it's you know, even before they see all of the dead cows, the way that Rip and Casey are talking about like, oh, and that's not around this time of year. You know, it's the kind of stuff you pick up
in the agricultural trade, right? Because there's such a cyclical nature to it when you're dealing with that working out on land. I've only ever worked really on large scale vegetable farms, but I've done a lot in wholesale produce distribution and seafood. So I'm not like a livestock guy, though my ex-wife was a grazing specialist in North Carolina for a long time. And I have some familiarity with this, but there's such a pattern to all of this. When you're out in the weather, you're dealing with seasonal effects. Like, there's certain things that are just quantifiable. Also, because like we've been herding cows for thousands of years, right? And there's just like there's stuff known within the space. So I thought they did a really good job communicating what's going on, why it's going on, and why it's relevant, especially like scattered across. And then the implications that you get from Jamie talking to Beth later. Like, you just think that there's 150 dead cows out there. That's $500,000. Right. And like, what do you think this ranch makes money on? Like, at the end of the year, after we pay all these ranchers, we got to buy hay. There's so much overhead when you're dealing with any kind of living product. I mean, it's the same with vegetables, and it's compounded to like the nth degree when you're dealing with any kind of animals, livestock. It gets really tricky, you know?
I think what I just like about it is that it's such a, like, it's a Yellowstone story. Like, there's not, you know, like, I'm not watching a lot of other TV where it's like, oh no, the cows are all blood. I know it sounds facetious. I actually love it. I think it's like, I do think the writing between Casey and Rip there, as he's like, you know, this is why it's really bad that this one cow has been bloated. And then they turn over the hill, and the shot of all the dead cows, I thought was like really strong. And then this, the way that, you know, one of the things I really liked from the beginning of season one is this idea of the external threats to John and the ranch. And this plays into this completely. And the fact that John does take a big loss in this battle, but then is also smart enough to know, like, okay, shit, like, I can't let the clover, you know, I can't let the clover die. And so this last image of him having to burn the, you know, the hay in his own field, to like prevent anything else from happening. I thought it was like just really great writing, cool imagery. There's lots of metaphor in there. I think it was really strong, this storyline in particular.
Yeah, I do as well, right? And I mean, we've talked about like the kind of political bent and the alignment of the show, but I think it does a really good way articulating the struggle of this kind of lifestyle. You know, we get this little side jaunt towards the end of the episode where Casey's out at his ride along, they're looking for the plane. He and the other livestock agents stop to deal with this rancher whose cow has been killed by wolves, right? And this is the like conservation crashing into like the actual agriculture industry in that way, where you have all of this kind of controversy. It's so easy for the people in the kind of bastions on the coast to be like, yes, save the wolves. But for this one really poor guy, he can't afford to hire any extra ranchers. He's got to protect the herd himself. The wolves kill his cow. That's $2,000 that he's like, I can't afford to lose. Right. I don't know about you. I'm sure a lot of people out there at this day and age in the world, $2,000 is not like an insignificant hit.
There's some
deleted from your bank account tomorrow, right?
There's some stat to show that like half of Americans couldn't afford a $200 surprise, like, you know. So yeah, definitely $2,000, no go.
And I just think the way that that's juxtaposed against his neighbor, meanwhile, who's making this false wildlife claim. He talks about, he's literally the boy who cries wolf, craze that he keeps like killing all these cows to get the government to pay these subsidies back to them for the actual like market loss that he has, and it's a whole like corruption. So I think it's a really interesting way to explore the kind of needs of these types of businesses and this type of enterprise and the way that it crashes up against government policies that seem like universally and ambiguously positive, but we can really overlook how they impact the people that have to live and work in these ecological spaces to like sustain their business, you know. I'm with you. I think it's really elegant writing to get us the actual details of why this is all relevant.
Yeah, so all this stuff on the Yellowstone Ranch, I for sure understand and get. I do have a clarifying question about this other stuff that happens.
Yes.
Is the idea that the man who eventually we turned out used the weed whacker on at least his own cow also did it on his neighbor's cow, or that one was legitimately a wolf? Because there's a paw print, right?
Yes, there is the paw print. Casey clocks it, right? So I think that that's a legitimate wolf attack, but that the neighbor has killed so many cows previously. And as the guy says, he cuts them all up so that he can make these claims to Fish and Game that they're being killed by wildlife, and he can ultimately get an insurance claim on it, is basically what we're doing.
So we're basically like, these two situations don't have anything to do with each other than the fact that they're seemingly both wolf related, but then the latter one isn't. Is that that's the idea? So that first piece is like mostly about, I'm just trying to think of the reason to put that first one in there. I get the first scene where like it's a legitimate wolf attack, which is like Casey being around, the idea of like there's no backup at the moment.
I think that, I mean, I'm with you. What is the reason to do the first stop that like gets us involved in this whole thing? And I think part of it is to show the way that Casey has empathy for this man, right? Right. Like the other livestock agents, like, ah, don't worry about it. We'll get you a check. Don't sweat it. You better get some guys out here. Uh-huh. And the old man's like, I can't afford guys. And the livestock agent's like, well, you could have fun sleeping out here, then, old man, mm-hmm. and walks off. But Casey can at least like offer some of the recourse. Go get some mules rent some angry mules and put them out there, and they can prevent it. So I think it's to show a little bit of the juxtaposition of the way that people take advantage of the like government programs, right? That mm-hmm. like the neighbor is capitalizing on this situation. He may or may not know that there was a real wolf attack, and so he's going to like piggyback onto it and ride the coattails of the situation. I think that there's like a very on the nose metaphor that Taylor Sheridan couldn't resist of like the neighbor crying wolf, right? And we need a way into that story to a degree. Right. So I'm with you where like, why show the first guy? But I think the first guy just serves to like articulate some empathy for Casey in particular, and why like he might actually be genuinely like really good at this job as a livestock.
We see him. The only thing I would say is that like we basically see that in the second scene too. Like it's not that I think like both, you know, you don't need to show it just once, and actually it's like not bad writing to show it twice. But also in the second scene, he basically is about to seemingly get the kid to like put his gun down, right? Like, and he's like, here's what actually is going to happen. Like it's no big deal. He's gonna pay a fine and he's gonna clean up some garbage on the weekend. And it's only that the guy, he hasn't put his gun down quite yet, that the actual sheriff ends up like shooting him. But we do see that he's like compassionate. He is like, he actually, yeah, could be quite competent at the job in, I think, in both situations. Again, I'm like not saying like they need to cut that first one. I was just like trying to maybe dig in a little bit about like, because I too thought that maybe they were more intertwined, which they are, in the sense that like maybe the second guy is saying like, oh, that guy got his wolf, I'm gonna go use my weed whacker to kill my cow and then get the insurance money or whatever. But yeah, I wondered if there were more intertwined than I was missing.
Well, the other like further complication is the first guy saying like, oh, they're never going to show up. Fishing Game's never going to show up because my neighbor keeps calling in false calls. And they like think we're full of bullshit. So they don't want to come out to this part of the world. It's the way that like these, you know, these kind of interactions can impact one another and are intertwined. And I think that it's showing like, because so much of the sheriff who we've met before, who's got this real bad taste in his mouth about Rip and seems to like love to argue with John so much, right? He's so reluctant to deputize Casey, and he tells him like, yeah, we know he knows how to use the gun, now you got to teach him how to not to use it. Like that thing comes out of your holster, there better be a goddamn good reason for it, right? Uh-huh. But the fact that he has this incredible restraint and that he's got this kind of measured approach and trying to de-escalate the conflict resolution as the kid comes out with the shotgun, he's seemingly like really good at this. And John's retort to the sheriff at that point is like, are you kidding? Casey like beat up the drifter who pulled a knife on him at a gas station. Like the cops would have done an even worse job, right? Yeah, which is a really fascinating commentary on police violence
from the conservative like right.
And I think that then we double down on it, where like the actual livestock agent is effectively going to murder what seems like a teenager, right? Who comes out here with the shotgun. I mean, maybe the son's like in his early 20s, but he's clearly a young man who comes out to defend his dad in the midst of this kind of conflict.
Yeah. Right. They call him a teen. I'm pretty sure.
I mean, that's what I thought. Yeah. And this livestock.
And the news says his teenage son.
There you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly sad. I Casey's response, I like that, even though like, yeah, the guy had a shotgun pointed at him, he still says like you can say it's justified. And he'll say later to his dad, he'll say like, yeah, it was probably justified, but whether it was actually right is another factor. Right. And then I do love this confrontation between John and the officer. Basically punches him, and then it's like, yeah, even though I punch you, like, dude, you are totally in the wrong. Like, this is your fault that this happened. You won't send backup out to come and help. And literally someone would not be dead if you sent someone out. So you're a fool. Yeah.
Yeah. Stupid sheriff. So back to like the Thomas and Dan of it all, I'm so curious about like your expectations. Like, do you think that John expects it's one of them, or that he thinks it's both of them? What do you think like John senses, where he's like, we know who did this? I'm just really curious if you have like a strong read there one way or another.
Yeah, I guess my thought is probably Thomas, because I feel like he's probably felt like his threatening of Dan Jenkins is probably enough. Also, there's so much, I don't know whether we know how much John knows about this, but Dan Dan seems so screwed in this whole situation. The fact
that Dan's got run right over.
Like,
yeah.
Dude, you got played so bad. Like, this is like, they're going to annex the thing. They don't owe you anything. You don't need, you know, they're telling him you don't need the alcohol license from the government because you'll get it from the tribe. And like, he's like, you know, he just is, does not love any of the ways this is going down. Then back to John, I feel like he feels like he must have threatened Dan enough, but maybe not if Dan's going to keep like poking. So maybe he feels like this is Dan pushing back on the fact that they hanged Dan. So my thought is probably just like both of them, I think, is probably mm-hmm. who John, like whether or not it was one, the other one is complicit is mm-hmm. is my feeling. And again, we cut right to from like, I know who did this to like,
To
the two of them.
Yeah. At the groundbreaking. I love the whole note. The way that Thomas manages Dan, it's so great. The kind of power dynamics between the two of them. It really is fun to see Dan like getting screwed by everybody, but he is officially getting screwed by everybody at this point, right? Like he seemingly had an opportunity last week to deal with the Beck brothers, and he just blows them off so hard that now he's like doubled down with Thomas and his assistants kind of telling him, like, you can't just believe in him and think that that's viable business strategy. But Thomas's insinuation to him of like, things are getting serious, we're the only two people playing honestly. Dan says like, are you insinuating I need security? He's like, yeah, you should have learned that already.
You got
Dan.
A bodyguard, bro. It's so
maybe
good.
You should have learned that when they took you out to hang you. I can't even believe you're asking this question, Dan Jenkins.
Yeah. So I think it is. I do like that. I like, there's a lot of stuff again. I'm going to kind of bleed into the Monica stuff here. Not so much the stuff with Casey, but just, again, this is a show that I think has a reputation, and I feel like, you know, it's, there's a lot of ways that they're talking about a lot of these issues that are very complicated. So when the groundbreaking is happening, you have a man being like, listen, I'm always going to support like Indigenous peoples having, you know, being business owners, but also like, how many casinos do you friggin' need? You know, like this is like not actually helping maybe as much as like they want you to believe it is. And then you cut to Monica giving her seminar, her lecture. Yeah. And then we cut to the end when the massage therapist comes and he's like, it's, you know, he's like, if you only teach them the tragedies, then they're going to think we're tragic. And so can you also show the celebration? Cause that's a big thing I feel like about, transness is like, I also, when I'm like, you know, if I do ever do a podcast, like on Rob is a podcast, and we're doing like the Pride is Spoken and things like that, I'm always trying to make sure that like, on one hand, like, yeah, life can really suck and be really hard when you're trans, especially like if you like don't have support systems, if you live in a government that or in a state that's trying to like legalize you out of existence, like, yeah, that shit sucks. Also, like, there is a lot of like trans joy in the world, or like queer joy in the world. And I think that's also important to like share with people. So like that resonated with me a lot as he comes in to like, you know, suggests maybe they go to the relay race, I believe is what he suggests. So yeah, I thought that just like the portrayals of that community, I think, are better than I was expecting from Yellowstone.
Yeah, I think that the show is really unfairly pigeonholed, right? And it just gets painted into its own corner. I think like a lot of media properties are. You have people that have expectations, and then they read whatever it is, the blurb, the headline, they hear the sound bite, and they're never going to actually like give it the credit of viewing it on their own and measuring it on their own. But I've talked a little bit about during my senior year in high school, I did kind of in-depth like year of study focusing on Indigenous people, specifically in Southwestern America. I went to New Mexico and Arizona. I stayed on the Zuni Indian Reservation for a time. And I think that the way that they use Monica as a character, and even to a degree Thomas Rainwater and the other Native American characters, to shine a little bit of a spotlight on the problems, then like the difficulties, the challenges that like are still persistent within the reservation system here in the U.S. It's pretty salient. You know, I mean, it's certainly not the focus or the emphasis of the show, but the fact is that we're not sugarcoating it. You know, it's not like this positive, upbeat portrayal. They're not being portrayed exclusively as these kind of villains against John and like his white family in the big giant like $1 billion ranch, right? We see the plight of Thomas Rainwater. We got that kind of sequence of him dealing with the like the youth who had kind of stepped wrong and driving through the reservation and wondering, what are we even fighting for? This notion of the casinos can generate incredible wealth, but also what type of like signal is that indicating for the future generations? You know, I know that alcoholism, drug abuse, like teen pregnancy, these are all like very, very major problems on a lot of the reservations in the U.S. and the ways that we're like approach the difficulties there and the challenges between like managing a population that is mixed between these two people with very different needs in the modern age, I do think is pretty interesting and pretty thoughtful in the way that they approach it.
I know there are some critiques of it in terms of like, again, this is typically white creators, white writers
writing for sure.
Indigenous representation. So it's not perfect, but I wanted to highlight that like, this is more than I thought was in there. So yeah,
for sure. I think Sheridan is notably criticized as somebody that doesn't have a very open writer's room, right? This is a guy who's like got a lot of control on what he is doing with these shows, especially with Yellowstone as the flagship show. I think when we watched 1923, Troy and Josh and I did a couple of podcasts on it, and there were some pretty negative depictions of Native American experiences there that we were like slightly critical of to varying degrees. So, you know, my mileage may vary and it's certainly imperfect, but I appreciate the inclusion rather than like sliding past it. Just to talk about the Monica and Casey of it all, the whole like, you know, she calls. The physical therapist is clearly like interested, and that's making her uncomfortable. And she calls Casey and says she wants to see him. She misses him, but don't. And then Casey shows up and Tate finds them together. Like, anything there that you want to like dig in on at all, Grace, or we're just like tracking it as it goes?
Yeah, just tracking it. I mean, it's funny in a show that's very like, you know, we've called it akin to a soap opera. Certainly for me, the thing that is not been in the show, and I kind of have loved that it's not been in the show, and I feel like this feels like the show trying to figure out this is a good place to do it, is basically a romantic storyline.
Love Beth, triangles.
Yeah. I guess Jamie has had the thing, you know, he had that at the end of last season too. I guess so. He's another character who's like on the, and then Beth has had some stuff, but that feels so much more like she's always being manipulative rather than like genuinely looking for love or like caught up in it at all. I'm sure there's more of this coming. Like, I feel like Casey and Monica, I don't know. I do get the idea that like you could, cause like they're trying to explore Casey and Monica being like separated basically. And so a natural tension to like fit in there is the idea that like she might fall for someone. And not that there's not something interesting about the idea that she had like married a man who's not Indigenous and then potentially being like, you know, interested in this man who is, and what that means about like her family. Actually, Killers of the Flower Moon does a really good job of this, as this one mother, like all of her daughters marry like white men. So like the confusion or like, you know, conflict that creates is interesting. So I don't know, noting it, I don't think there's like a ton here other than what I've already sort of highlighted.
Yeah, very fair. I want to talk about Jamie and Beth and the attorney general elect, this whole notion of like Cassidy coming in and the way that Beth is like so aggressively baiting Jamie. I mean, she's trolling him, right? Is very much what's happening. Is they're having this meeting and John's kind of talking to Cassidy, is her name, about, hey, Dan Jenkins, Thomas Rainwater, we need you to get involved in this real estate deal. And she starts asking about like, oh, what about the Senate committing for like, or the Senate like hearing for the overreach of like the Livestock Association, and Beth is like so just trying to destroy Jamie, and they have this conflict here where she says, I'm gonna get you disbarred, you son of a bitch, like you never should have come back. And he's like, you told me to come back. And she's like, yeah, why in a million years would you ever think it's a good idea to listen to me? This to me, Grace, just so embodies Beth, like that singular exchange. I'm like, you told me to come back, that's why I came back. Like, yeah, you idiot, you shouldn't listen to me. She's just such a viper, and I find her like, you know, her kind of, it's not chaotic, she's really ordered and she's pretty like defined in what she's doing, but it's so erratic, like which direction she's going to go in a minute. She feels like a very unpredictable character despite the fact that she's so kind of capable and cunning and savvy and all of it. But the two of them, this conflict is mounting to a pretty dangerous point, it feels like for me.
Yeah. I mean, this to me feels like Beth is getting close to the level she was when she was sort of like around the time of her mother's death, right? So it does feel like she goes into these waves of being incredibly focused on something, and then these times where, you know, this is like the sort of agenda. I mean, he says it. He says like, if you're gonna, you know, if you're, what is it? If your reason to live if you need a reason to live, and it's like by hating someone, and it needs to be me, something like that, right? When like,
yeah, he's like, if you need to like hate me to like be happy to stay alive, then go ahead, hate me. Yeah.
Yeah. So to that degree, she's doing it maybe more than he anticipated of like literally trying to get him disbarred. The problem for me, I think, with this stuff is that I feel like it's mostly Jamie. I'm like not really super interested in Jamie at the moment. I feel like he's so just a little bit lost, which I guess is the point. And maybe this is better than him running for attorney general. So I'm maybe fine with that. It's so vindictive from Beth in a way that I think is. And I also wonder, like, why? Like, what is it in Jamie specifically? And maybe that's part of it. Of like, he does try to branch out, and when it doesn't work, like his father brings him back. I thought that was really interesting, potentially, of this idea of, you know, the same way that Casey tries to like break out on his own, and then he comes back and he slowly becomes more and more like his father. And Jamie maybe slowly having to do more and more things that he like hates doing because he's like under the thumb of his father and not really maybe even getting to like utilize. Someone in this episode says, like, I saw him in court, like he was very good, you know. And so that's interesting to me, while also having like Beth Sabbath. I guess I do like the dynamic here. Like, I think it's like more complex than most shows I've watched, where like she is in front of her father constantly, and you know he does like go and stop her, right? From she's like,
not the time, not the place, he tells her in that first meeting. It's just relentless. I mean, she's doing it when they're in the meeting with the Governor Linnell, and she's asking, is that a good date for you to swear in the new Attorney General, Jamie? Then again back at the meeting at the house, then the whole situation with dinner. It's just like so vindictive and controlling, and John seems to put up with a lot of her bullshit, Grace, where he's like so hard on his sons. She's got like a little bit more of a lead to kind of play around with.
But this is also what he said, right? He's like, I need somebody who can be evil. She's being pretty friggin' evil, even if it's to Jamie. And I also wonder if there's a degree to which when it's in their own home, you know, without, you know, Cassidy is there for both. Cassidy, this woman who's going to be the attorney general or is or whatever. She is there for both encounters. The one where it's like much more businessy and John shuts it down. The other one being like this like family dinner. It is interesting to me whether or not like John obviously to some degree doesn't want it to be, he doesn't want to like destroy his kid. I don't think he wants him disbarred, but also is he okay with like the idea that like Jamie gets a little bit of punishment and like the pecking order is like established a little bit in terms of like, you tried to step out and this is what it looks like when you step back in and you step in line and you know, so I kind of think it's interesting. I was talking about this with another show where I thought it was interesting in the way that when people object morally, but then actually don't fully stop things from happening. And I want, this is a little bit of that where like, I feel like they kind of get to the point where like, it's a joke line where like, John's like, he has what? Because he does stop the meeting, but alas, I think it's interesting to watch. It'll be interesting to watch how John handles Beth poking at Jamie.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I mean, if we recall John in season one, there's a point where he tells Beth, like, she's more man than I'm any of them, right? And like, it's a very like kind of explicit thing there, the way that he's allowing her to kind of dominate Jamie so much. The whole musical chairs thing, I don't know how much this relates for your experience, Grace, but I come from a family where there was like that moment of like Thanksgiving dinner and everybody walks into the room and who's sitting where, because sometimes become like a violent eruption that involves like flying mashed potatoes and shattered China and like a lot of volatility, right? Because the whole maneuver is like Cassidy sits down and Beth like immediately puts her off her guard, like, no, you're in Casey's chair, but Casey's not coming for dinner, and she moves Cassidy to Jamie's chair.
It's very smart.
He's like, you're not gonna get the chair. So Jamie goes for the chair that was presumably his mother's, to which Beth is gonna be like, don't even, you bastard, don't even look at it, don't even consider sitting in her chair. Right? I mean, there's just like such a dynamic at play. Now that I'm actually thinking about it, it might not be her mother's, it's probably Lee's chair.
I think it's Lee's chair because it's not
in order on that side of the table.
Yeah, right at the end, you think that she might sit at the other end, right? So I think it's Lee's. I think it's probably Lee's
chair. I think that that's correct now that we're reflecting on it. But it's all just like a setup to get him to come around and sit down next to her so that she could stab him under the table with a steak knife, Grace. I know you got siblings, but like, I don't know. This one I never dealt with.
No, we weren't, you know, as much as we sometimes hated each other, we definitely weren't going to stab each other. But I think that the thing about where you sit, I think it's, I recently was at a conference, a couple of conferences where like, there was like a lot of these like big dinners, and boy, it was like, you're like, praying you're not next to the people that you like. You're like praying, you're hoping next to the people that you actually like would love to spend like a 2 hour dinner with. Right. Oh, you're like, no, don't sit there. You don't sit there. Oh, that's the last chair. Huh? Okay. I'm going to be at the other end of the table.
Can I please just hold your hand so I can slide in next?
I know. I'm like, oh, I'm at this end of the table. Like, okay. All right. Fun. You know, that's to me the bigger one. But yeah. And I'm sure my parents as a kid were like looking at the table and being like, that's a bad setup. Like that one's going to cause some fights in the way that John's just watching them all. But again, he doesn't interact. He just lets Beth do it all, right? He just like, you know, so
he does, though he seems really put out by it.
He says, last episode, right? Isn't the ending of last episode like, why'd you leave me alone? Because of this stuff, you know? Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The Becks. I just want to talk about the Becks a little bit. They show up. We get this meeting of the Beck brothers with John Dutton. They basically give him the pitch. I love Rip just like beating the hell out of their security guys while they watch on, like with this kind of smug amusement, guns just pointed everywhere. Grace as they bust me. And ultimately, like John's going to roll up. He's gonna be, like full cowboy style. He comes charging up on the horse. He's kicking people over and stuff. Jamie comes out and is like, whoa, 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 everybody be cool. And John like seemingly wants nothing to do with it until they go and talk, and the Becks are like, listen, our business of gas stations and casinos does not overlap with yours. We would make real good allies. And John's got this thing of like, yeah, I don't care. I don't need allies. I don't need partners. I'm going to do what's best for my family. And if it works out for you, that's like a coincidence and nothing more. Here is this like mounting tension. Where do you think this is going?
Because there's also the stinger at the end, right, where he said the Becks say like, oh, I think I know how we can help
yes.
John Dutton, which is seemingly they're going to interfere with potentially some of the livestock association stuff that is happening. I kind of love the idea of characters who get introduced who are not necessarily threats to John Dutton, but instead are like little gnats who are like, you know, trying to like actually cling on, and they've always like known to stay out of his way, but they kind of can't help themselves as there's just like this communal threat that they both have to try and like, you know, tag along with the Yellowstone Ranch and John Dutton and try to like get in with him. I think that that's kind of fun in the way that it's not an external threat. It's more of this like, it's almost, they're almost like the Steve Urkel to Carl Winslow.
As just he's rolling like, he's like, right into the house.
Yeah, yeah, just like, rolling right in and be like, oh, come on, get out of here.
You again?
Yeah, so I kind of love that, especially because I just think I can't remember this guy. What's his name? I want to say
Neil McDonough.
I think he's just like plays Weasley pretty well. So I kind of like this role for him as one of the Beck brothers. Yeah. I also think it's interesting that like as much as John was trying to get Casey, you know, and telling Rip to like train Casey to be up, Rip's still pretty in with John. I think it's when Jamie is going to go with him to talk with the Becks, and he says like, no, get out of here, like you're not coming. And then Rip joins the conversation, so, and then Rip's the one like fighting the Beck brothers. Is pretty fun, although I guess as Thomas Rainwater said, like pretty good to have a bodyguard. I guess Rip is essentially John's bodyguard.
Yeah, so, Rip's a strong man. Rip has quietly one of my favorite moments of the entire episode, where he's talking to Casey in the very opening scene about Jimmy. Like, yeah, he's a good kid.
Yeah.
Shut up, Jimmy. Stop asking questions.
No, I thought this line is really good. Of like, he's a good kid, and Casey says, if he's a good kid, why does he have the brand? I thought that was really good. So,
oh yeah, it's really it's quite excellent.
Yeah.
That's episode 4, season 2 of Yellowstone, All the Devils. Grace, anything that we didn't get into that you want to just note before we part ways?
No, I don't think so.
I feel like it was a pretty tight episode. It cruises right along. I do love the imagery at the end, the fire burning.
Yeah.
I'll give a little PSA. It's a really great visceral shot of these two guys pointing their flamethrowers at one another.
Oh, yeah.
To the ignition. If you are about to like go out into a field to set it on fire with your friends, do not point your flamethrowers at your friends.
Yeah.
You both are supposed to turn in the same direction. Think like, imagine it like you're Ghostbusters and you just can't do not want to cross the streams.
Yeah.
Don't cross the streams. Yeah. Off your flamethrowers that you may bad or may news. Have gotten from Tesla.
No, good episode. I think like 4 episodes in here. It looks like the next couple weeks they're like doubling up again. It looks like I thought that maybe they were going to air more Lawmen Bass Reeves on Sunday nights.
Me too.
It looks like that might have just been the premiere to get people to watch it on Paramount Plus, I think. So moving forward, it looks like 2 episodes of Yellowstone every Sunday, 2 next week and 2 after, which then sets up basically there's only would be 2 left for like up to end season 2, basically. So we could be done season 2 in 3 weeks, Rich.
I'm ready for it, Grace. Yeah. Get me there. Let's ride to the far side of the ranch. We will be back in 1 week's time talking about episodes 5 and 6 of the second season of Yellowstone. But until then, what do you got going on? Where can people find you?
I got a lot going on, actually. There's a lot of stuff coming. As stuff sort of wrapped up, I also have stuff that that's starting. So Aaron and I wrapped up the morning show recently. We're going to be very close to wrapping up Tales from the Loop. Aaron and I are talking about movies each week. We should be talking about the Marvels, the MCU film, which had the lowest MCU opening weekend of all time. I loved the movie. I thought it was so fun.
But press, writer strike, actor strike, no promotion. No promotion from the actors absolutely devastates the box office for these things.
Yeah. Our Flag Means Death also wrapped up, but we are very exciting. Sarah Carradine announced this on Twitter. We are going to be speaking with the costume designer from that show, Gypsy Taylor, who just did some incredible work. And we got lots of great questions on Twitter. So check out that if you want to ask any questions of Gypsy Taylor. So all of that. And then The Crown comes back this week. And Dr. Amanda and I are chatting about The Curse, which is the new Nathan Fielder, Emma Stone, Benny Softee show, which is wild, and we talk way more about micro penis than I would have ever thought on a podcast. So check that out. That's my little tease, my little teaser for that podcast.
It's a tiny tease.
Yeah. I'm on social media at High From Grace. What about you, Rich?
Yeah. DM Philly in all the places. We just wrapped up coverage of The Winter King. First season is over. It was a pretty good show over on MGM Plus. Corey B and myself have just begun coverage of Beacon 23. Lena Headey is back playing one of the main characters on this new show, also on MGM Plus. Very cool. You talked about Tales from the Loop. I'm doing some stuff with you. I'm hanging out. I'm around. Go follow me in all the places. We'll be back next week talking about episodes 5 and 6 of season 2 of Yellowstone. But until then, just remember, I'll have that $8,000 real soon. I promise, real soon.